Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and at age 19, she decided to enter the Sisters of St. Joseph of Nazareth. She earned a bachelor's degree from Nazareth College and master degrees from Mary Grove and Western Michigan University. She's been a Hall of Famer in three distinct ministries: elementary education, HUD housing, and health administration. A most amazing woman with a fantastic resume. Her name, Sister Betty Granger. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Sister Betty Granger, who has one of the most amazing resumes in the history of the world. Sister, welcome. An honor to have you.
Thank you.
Can we start by you offering us an opening prayer as we embark on 2022?
I'd be happy to. I have a New Year blessing. May you be aware of all the places your feet carry you in the new year. May you not be afraid of the questions that press upon your mind and heart. May you be the one with welcome in your smile and hello etched upon your hand, the hand you extend to everyone who blesses you with their presence. May yours be the gift of reverence for all created things. May you face bravely and enthusiastically the responsibility to preserve and care for the earth. May the wellspring of compassion flow deep within you. May you awake each morning with thank you on your lips and in your heart, recognizing that all is gift, that all is blessing. May your friendship with God be strong and healthy. May your spirit be open and perceptive in discovering the will of God for you. May your life this new year be a living legacy to your God. Amen.
And may you also be with Sister Betty Granger, who, by the way, lives that prayer every day of her life. Sister, let's start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please.
I remember my childhood as happy, within a loving family, but not without discipline. I'm not sure why I altered those two, but we did have discipline. There were things we could do and not do. We were not rich, but we had what we needed. Mom had been orphaned by the time she was age six, but was cared for by the extended family, a large German family of aunts and uncles. She focused on the happy times from her childhood. Dad's mother had died when he was only six or so, so life soon included for him a stepmother who was the grandma we knew when growing up. There were three of us for a long time, and when I was a junior in high school, Mom had another baby. There were four girls then. I always called Mary our bonus baby.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad, who was a convert, by the way?
Yes. Oh, it's interesting because I have that in my own comments. I think their lives taught me resilient. We really were not ever well off. I didn't even know at that time what middle class meant. But and I didn't think I recognized the resilience that they both had until I was older. Also, we learned right from wrong. And the importance of family. Their faith played a role as well. And as you mentioned, my father was a convert to Catholicism. And Mom said one time to me, converts were the best Catholics.
In many cases, I believe that as well. When did you know you had a vocation to be a sister, a nun?
Well, coming from a family of four girls who often spent Sunday afternoon visiting our aunt, who was a sister of St. Joseph, and I'd say almost, not quite every month, but we would go down to Kalamazoo to visit her. We were accustomed to being asked, so which one of you is going to be a sister? And we were just as accustomed to passing it off to the next in line. But as a senior in high school, I found it was no longer to dismiss the thought so easily. And when my parents and I discussed the possibility of entering religious life as one option for the future after high school, they encouraged me to go to college or work a year to have the added experience before taking such a step.
1956 is when you entered the Order of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Nazareth in Kalamazoo. Tell us about your order, sister.
The Sisters of St. Joseph were, were founded in 1651. We weren't the only religious order in the 1600s. There were events happening in what we now know as Europe. So in 1651, a group of women in Le France, already ministering to orphans, bonded together to form the congregation, the first group of Sisters of St. Joseph, with the encouragement and help of a Jesuit priest, Father Medai. During the Revolution, the order was dispersed and five of the women were guillotined. But by the early 1800s, the sisters were again staffing schools, hospitals, orphanages, and institutions for the deaf throughout France. In 1836, eight of the women came to America, settling in Carondelet near St. Louis, Missouri. And from that initial foundation, the order spread throughout the United States and Canada. 10 sisters from Watertown, New York, responded to a request from Monsignor Francis O'Brien in the Kalamazoo Diocese at the time to staff a 20-bed hospital in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And this foundation would be known as the Congregation of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Nazareth. We were founded to do anything in response to needs that that woman is capable of. The spirituality described in original or primitive documents, as they are called, spoke of a deep union with God and with the neighbor, and described Sisters of St. Joseph as women of reconciliation. Vatican II's call to return to the spirit of the founders was a call given to all religious congregations. And then there were updates and changes after that, but not without returning to our original purpose for being founded.
Tell us about a forgotten saint, Saint Joseph.
We often focus on the fact that Mary, a virgin, was chosen by God to be Jesus' mother, but we overlook Joseph, as you just said, who was chosen by God to be Jesus' earthly father. The Bible tells us in the Gospel of Matthew that Joseph was a righteous man. His actions toward his fiancée, Mary, revealed that he was a kind and sensitive man. When Mary told him she was pregnant, he had every right to feel not only confused, but also disgraced. He knew the child was not his own, and Mary's apparent unfaithfulness carried a grave social stigma. While his initial reaction was to break off the engagement, the appropriate thing for a righteous man to do, which would have been appropriate, he treated Mary with extreme kindness and respect. He didn't want to cause her further shame. And fortunately for him, God sent an angel to Joseph to verify Mary's story and reassure him that his marriage for her was God's will. Joseph willingly obeyed God in spite of the public humiliation he would face. And this move speaks volumes about his character and his faith. I don't think that we know a lot more about, he's often pictured teaching Jesus carpentry and that kind of thing. But he's a very sort of hidden individual. But he must have been a wonderful person.
We're talking to Sister Bretta Granger. When we come back, we're going to ask her about her 20-year career in elementary education. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Sister Bretta Granger. And from 1958 to 1976, her ministry was elementary education. Sister, tell us about that 20-year chapter.
Okay. I do want to mention that at this period of time, we were wearing what we affectionately call the old habit, the full habit with black dress and a white gimp and then the veil and so on. And as you have described, my first assignments were about 20 years in elementary ed, which I loved it. I had fourth, fifth, and sixth grades for some time, and then eventually moved to junior high when I was missioned to Kalamazoo, Michigan, St. Augustine. And my last 10 years in elementary ed, I was principal at St. Augustine. One time, and this always seems to strike people, and I only have one memory of a student who I don't know whether you'd say acting out. It wasn't meanness or anything like that, but he was a jitterbug, and I do remember him. I remember his name, but I'm not going to use it. Just in those days. We had classes, and I'm speaking of fourth grade right now, as large as 56. People just
wondered. Can you say that again? Can you say that again?
We had classes as large as 56. And I dare to say it probably was easier than it is today with in some instances with classes as small as 20 or so. I don't know how we did it, but part of it was parental interest and backup. So I loved it. I had a wonderful time in elementary ed and also as principal. I loved doing that.
I think the kid you're mentioned is a kid named Ricky, and he was Eddie Haskell before there was Eddie Haskell. So okay, let's go on. Then in 1976, your order says, "Sister, we need you to serve in HUD housing as a manager for low-income senior citizens." So you went from teaching fourth, fifth, sixth graders to now serving senior residents. Tell us about that chapter.
Yes, that was a request from leadership, from congregational leadership. And so before the school year began in September of 76, before that year even began, I knew it would be my final year at St. Augustine and in a career, so to speak, that I had loved a great deal. Deliberations had been in process with the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The congregation's proposal was approved. We had an empty college dorm. In fact, we had two of them, but we asked to renovate one of them into a HUD 202. And the renovation was begun on a student dormitory at Nazareth College, located on the campus of our mother house. I'd been asked to serve as the resident manager, and I wanted to mention the congregation saw to it that I received training. I think I went to New York as a professional housing manager before assuming responsibility for that 75-unit project for low-income seniors, which still stands. Dillon Hall is still on the campus of Nazareth. I loved that ministry as well. It was entirely different. I went from grade school students to seniors. And it was a wonderful five-year period of my life. I've always enjoyed the ministries that I've been asked to participate in.
Serving those senior citizens, what's the biggest thing they taught you, sister?
Oh, my. Probably acceptance. Was low income, so that tells you one thing that they all had in common. Their friendliness to one another, their family inclusion. I can't think of anybody that didn't have, unless their kin was already gone or whatever, but they still had family connections. I can remember family members coming to visit them and so on. It was a real learning experience for me. who was middle-aged at the time, learning from seniors.
Through the years, I've heard things that whenever people serve the poor, they say, I've learned much more from the poor than I ever did from the rich. Why is that so?
I think they're defining that we sometimes define poor only in terms of financial. And these individuals at Dillon were not poor in any aspects except perhaps that one. They were rich in relationships and in their family involvement and that kind of thing. Does that kind of get at it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And an awful lot of them have a much stronger faith.
Exactly.
The wealthy do, right?
Yeah.
Because they realize they need God, right, in their lives.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So, okay. 1983. You get another call from the Mother Superior. Sister, new mission for you. We need you in the healthcare industry as an administrator. And they send you to Flint, Michigan. So that starts another 30-year chapter. Tell us about that first hospital in Flint, Michigan.
St. Joseph Hospital in Flint had been founded back in the 1920s. Bishop Gallagher from the Diocese of Detroit had asked the Sisters of St. Joseph to establish St. Joseph Hospital. So it goes way back. And the sisters brought with them a mission of caring for all people in need that began with the founding of their order in France, which I had mentioned earlier. They arrived in Flint on September 25th, 1920, and opened St. Joseph Hospital at the former Stockton residence on Ann Arbor Street. And I'm trying to think, it was, they had to renovate, of course. And it became a 53-bed hospital, it's a large-sized home. It's still there in Flint. But when it opened officially, 1921, 12 beds were already occupied. And by the end of the year, the hospital had treated 450 patients. So then they purchased, Sisters of St. Joseph purchased the building from the diocese, and it was the Mother Superior of the sisters who had the good foresight to purchase what at that point was 26 acres way out in the country. It is now right in the city of Flint on the Dallas Dort Estate at the east side of Flint, and that became the new St. Joseph Hospital. There's a lot of history there, but St. Joseph Hospital was the mothership, so to speak, and since then that healthcare facility has moved to Genesis in Grand Blanc. A lot of history in the Flint healthcare.
Talking to Sister Betty Granger, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula. We're with Sister Betty Granger, a most phenomenal lady with three Hall of Fame careers in elementary education, HUD housing, healthcare administration. Okay, Sister, let's go to 1999. You bring together the Sisters of St. Joseph and the Daughters of Charity's hospital systems. Duck soup, easiest job you ever had in your life. How did you do it?
It's quite a story. It could be said that Ascension Health's journey actually began in 1993 when the Sisters of St. Joseph of Nazareth, we met to develop a long-term vision for the future of our healthcare ministry. Catholic health systems were facing all the challenges of the 90s, and groups of religious women who historically had led these systems felt the need to address the declining numbers among their members, which impacted the ability to continue to sponsor. We as SSJs were ahead even in this piece of it because we had a lay CEO by that time already at St. John's in Detroit. The leadership of the Daughters of Charity National Health System was beginning to discuss the need for a new approach, which would enable them to weather financial storms and promote the ideals of Catholic healthcare into the future. So the SSJs reached the conclusion they needed to find one or more partners. And as part of this model, they desired to create a larger leadership role for the laity. That was an important component that any partner would have to agree with in order for a partnership based on that to be strong and vital. So by 95, we were ready, SSJs, to implement our desire, and the Daughters of Charity had also considered the need. I think I would mention our president, Janet Fleshhocker, and the Daughters of Charity chair of their national board. Their four provinces had come together. They were a national system. We were only Michigan. Sister Xavier Balance. Those two women were very instrumental in making this happen from the beginning, or at the beginning. Then both systems could approach the co-sponsorship from a position of financial soundness and competitive strength, and both shared a common vision about the future of Catholic healthcare and their role as sponsors. In other words, knowing that we needed to welcome, we already were welcoming lay participation, and eventually the laity would become the sponsors. That has taken place. The commitment of the sponsors was a strong force in making the partnership work and the willingness of the sponsors to cross the threshold.
In the last 25 years, the number of proposed mergers between this hospital system and that hospital system that has not happened, it's been a disaster, is legendary. You know, these group of doctors can't get along with their doctors, et cetera. The easy thing is a contract, you know, all of the numbers, bringing two families together, sister, when they're all free agents, is the much more difficult thing. How did you do it?
The issue of culture was the biggest challenge to overcome, it seems to me. Each organization's culture, we had a long history of tradition and success behind it. The Daughters were highly centralized, structured decision-making process, and more than 200 people at its national office, but they were a national system. The SSJs, by contrast, had fewer than 20 people in its main office and relied on decentralized, less formal organizational structure. The Daughters' history and tradition was much more visibly apparent in pictures and so on and statues throughout their buildings, their hospitals and clinics. And the Sisters of St. Joseph, SSJs had engaged lay leadership over a longer period of time. The partnership required people to set aside what had been successful for them for many years in order to form something that had the promise to be even better. And when you ask, how did you do it? We all worked at it, especially leadership of the two groups. It was about relationships, and the co-sponsorship was built on trusting relationships and a spirit of mutuality. The goal was to work toward consensus, and the sponsors worked hard to understand each other's point of view and to get past the differences in style so they could focus on creating a new model of Catholic healthcare. It wasn't all fun. I'm not here to tell you that it was. On November 1st, 1999, the Daughters of Charity National Health System and the Sisters of St. Joseph Health System formally entered into a new co-sponsorship arrangement, making Ascension Health the system's parent organization for all their facilities and operations. One of the sponsors recalls there was a consciousness of something new, something irreversible being born. It gave us all hope for the future of Catholic healthcare. For as hard as some of it was to get to that point, it was a thrilling moment. November 1st, 1999.
As I've talked to people that know you, they think the world of you. Your serving, caring attitude, your Christ-centeredness. And another thing they say is, Jack, she's a phenomenal listener. And that's been a big part of the success. Talk to us about listening, sister.
Well, I'm happy to hear that people have said that about me. Sometimes I was pleased. It's so well. Even as in the coming together of these two organizations and so on, you have to be listening to the other side, the other view, and hear what they're saying, and then trying to understand it. And sometimes it comes off entirely differently. I'm almost surprised that people would say that about me, but it's so important. And when I think back to 22 years ago, to these beginning years of bringing these two major systems together, even though one was larger than the other, people were deeply embedded in the history and so on, and the of what they had grown up in healthcare, and it was not easy. So there, I'm not remembering it in detail, but there must have been an awful lot of listening among us at the time.
Okay. Now we go from you listening to other people to us listening to you. So I'm going to quote you. I believe that ministry is not a place or position, but a presence of being with others. What do you mean by that, sister?
Well, it's interesting. I thought, because I thought a great deal about that in when it was on your list of questions and so on. Ministry is often defined as, in fact, I looked it up yesterday, and it's like a priest, any person committed to a life in a church, in a congregation, and so on. And this ministry, the meaning of the word to me is broader than that. It's the way you do your calling, how you perform it, but how you do it. And ministry is a calling. So I found it difficult to elaborate even more than that. But it's because the word calling, of course, has a great deal of depth. So there are probably a lot more ministers in this world than we realize.
In your 30 years of health administration, what did you learn from the patients?
Patients, I think, and those I was in administration, but and those who are closer to the bedside could tell you even more. But patients tell us what is really important in when they become a patient. What is it that they need most? And I believe that what most of them speak to is the caring attitude of their caregivers and the gentleness and the with which they are handled, isn't a good word, when they become patients in one of our facilities, or it may be in an outpatient facility. I think sometimes we're inclined to think more about the multi-million dollar equipment and so on. That's not it. That isn't what patients say. Gee, I'm glad to hear you got a new heart machine. It's the heart of the nurse coming to their bedside. Does that describe it?
Yes. We're talking to Sister Betty Granger, and from 1981 to 2011, she was Vice President of Mission Integration for Ascension Health. When we come back, we're going to talk to her about the largest Catholic healthcare system in America, Ascension Health. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Jack Krasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Sister Betty Granger. For 30 years, she was Vice President of Mission Integration for Ascension Health. Ascension Health has more than 150,000 employees, 40,000 aligned physicians or providers. They operate 2,600 sites of care, including 142 hospitals and more than 40 senior living facilities in 19 states and District of Columbia. Sister, what more you want to add about Ascension Health, the largest Catholic healthcare system in America?
One thing that I would say, and it's sort of a continuation of where I was going earlier, the creation of Ascension Health meant that Catholic healthcare will continue to exist even after we, at that time, the current sponsors, we're no longer the sponsors, are gone. By the sponsors, by the sisters, the daughters and the sisters coming together, we were able to create something that's true to our beliefs and the sponsors, and we've made great progress in clarifying our role and in letting go of old responsibilities. We've succeeded in building trusting relationships and helping to create a culture that is consistent with the mission and vision we had envisioned. I believe that much of that, we're pretty much out of the picture now. There may be a few daughters on boards across the country yet, but leadership is lay, including Joan Pichike, who is president of the national system. I can't think of any areas of disappointment. It's pretty much worked out. 22 years now, I believe we're celebrating. And it was definitely the right thing to do to assure the future of Catholic healthcare.
When we go back 2 years, most every hospital system in America let thousands of people go because they just focused on COVID. Ascension was the opposite. Ascension did not lay off one person of the 150,000 team members. Amazing, sister. Amazing. That cost you some financial side, but the value and the teammanship that you got. There's a culture of love every time I go into an Ascension hospital. There's just an aura. How is that?
I want to relate that to the lack of the layoff and the promise that there would not be one, at least in the COVID setting and so on. Important for the employees, we call them associates, to experience the that promise from the sort of the mothership, if you want to call it that. It must have been a great deal to the employees to at least be assured that they wouldn't be on the street, so to speak. The culture of love that permeates throughout Ascension. We have our problems. I don't think anything is utopia, but we've worked very hard at inculcating we established a set of values before we literally became Ascension Health. The year before, we worked hard on that, and it was people from the daughters and people and employees from the sisters and so on. So from day one, I would say that a values-based, value-centered culture has probably been the root of a lot of that.
All right, talking about root, most people if they toil and become Hall of Fame in one ministry in their life, that's fantastic. You've done it three times. Elementary education for 20 years, HUD housing for 5 years, healthcare administration for 30 years. Three distinct, very different. How did you do it? Where did you ever get the courage to take on these great challenges?
I've been so blessed. I have just been so blessed. When you talk about it that way, I think, how did I do that? I've loved each one of them. I'd be perfectly okay, I think, if I were still in elementary school, but I don't think any of us are. I loved the seniors, and I loved healthcare, which was really my longest ministry, my last 30 years. So I did it through the grace of God.
Speaking of the grace of God, another thing that people that know you say, Jack, she is a shining example of a person who just trusts God. She lets go and lets God use her. That's so hard for most of us to do, sister, because we want to be in control. How do we learn to let go and let God?
I can't say that I know because surprises me. I think in my earlier years, I might have been seen as more, but I'm grateful to have that be people's perception. Obviously, in moving from elementary ed to HUD housing and then ultimately to healthcare, it had to be somebody besides me. And so it was grace without a doubt. Much of your life is, and I think sometimes I, for one, haven't always given that enough consideration. I've been very, very blessed, very blessed. My family has continued. My folks are long gone, but my sisters continue to, even in retirement, they continue to be supportive and loving and that kind of thing. So I hope I live up to the compliment.
Sister Betty Granger, everybody that's ever met you has been blessed and is better because of knowing you. So thanks for all you've done. Thanks for all you continue to do. Keep up the great, great work.
Thank you.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Pasul. Thanks for listening and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.
Believe in yourself.